Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is not the Middle East we thought we knew. Rock-solid U.S. ally Turkey striking out on its own, doing diplomacy Washington does not like with Iran, lambasting its old friend Israel over the Gaza flotilla, and more. Iran all smiles and unfazed in the face of U.N. sanctions. Big international reporter and analyst Stephen Kinzer says it's time we looked to the horizon and saw who our closest friends will one day be in the Middle East. This hour On Point, his case: Iran, Turkey, and the USA, best friends forever. Israel, Saudi Arabia, maybe not, maybe something else. And we'll hear a counterview. You can join the conversation. Where do you see the best long-term American alliances in the Middle East? Could one really be with Iran? Could Israel live with that? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We begin today in Istanbul, Turkey, with Mark Champion, bureau chief there for the Wall Street Journal. Mark, thank you for being with us.
Not at all. Thank you.
Turkey has gotten way out front on the angry response to Israel's deadly attack on the flotilla. Where does that stand now? What's the state of things? They threatened, they called it a massacre, called it state terrorism. The prime minister there threatened to cut off relations with Israel. Where does that stand, Mark?
Well, there are two elements to that. One is that eight of their citizens and one American citizen of Turkish descent were killed. So in terms of pure domestic politics, mm-hmm. the reaction has to be very strong.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be the case pretty much anywhere. However, it comes in the context of a policy decision that Turkey took a little more than 18 months ago now, when they simply decided when the Israel went into the Gaza Strip, they decided then that they were going to change their relationship with Israel and really change their relationship with the Middle East. And as soon as they decided that, it also meant that they were going to have to at least rebalance their relationship with the U.S. They're much more assertive now. This has really accelerated in a very aggressive way a process that was already underway.
Is Prime Minister Erdogan still on the sort of, warpath would be the wrong word, but, you know, very hot about the attack? Are people saying to him, let's cool down? After all, there's a long history of alliance between Turkey and Israel.
Well, there is. He is not cooling down. He's at the best of times, he's a pretty emotional politician, an extremely astute politician, but he plays to the crowd, and he is, in any case, quite emotional, and in particular on this issue and on Israel. So he is not calming down. However, if you look at what the foreign ministry is doing, it's not quite as lurid as what the prime minister says, and they do leave wiggle room to, you know, sort of retain at least part of the relationship beyond this, they haven't yet taken a decision to cut all ties. They do still have a substantial military to military relationship. They do still have significant, though not enormous, trade, and they do still have the kinds of political ties with Israel that are very useful if you want to have a comfortable relationship with Washington in the Middle East, too.
What about Turkey and the U.S.? Is that fabric tearing? It was already pretty frayed when Brazil and Turkey cut their own deal with Iran on its nuclear program. Hillary Clinton was quite critical on that front. And now Turkey, Ankara, has been very critical of Washington in the aftermath of the flotilla raid. Washington not being as critical of Israel as Turkey would like. Where does that relationship stand?
I think there's a significant risk that long-term irreparable damage is done to the relationship.
Wow.
It's not inevitable, but there is a significant risk. That is something that some people, columnists and opposition politicians and so on, have been saying here, not terribly loudly, because there's pretty much unanimity on the anger at Israel. But some people have been saying, you know, that you need to dial it back a little bit. that the really heavy rhetoric that kind of whips up the public is not a good idea. It could create a hostage to fortune, put you in boxes and corners mm-hmm. that you just can't get out of. And that there is a possibility that you do real damage to your relationship with Washington.
The rubber meets the road in the UN. Maybe today, the UN Security Council scheduled to vote on new sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. Turkey has not been very supportive. I mean, we're reading that 12 out of 15 countries on the Security Council appeared committed to supporting this U.S.-led drive for sanctions. Turkey happens to be on the Security Council right now. What's their vote to be?
Well, you know, it could be an abstention or it could be a no. I simply don't know. But my own guess would be that it will be a no. And that they will, that the logic of their position, the logic of Brazil's position, is very clear that they have made a separate deal, one that was initially initiated by the U.S. back in October, they feel that that deal is sufficient to be worth pursuing, to go back to the table, to get into talks. And it's going to be very difficult to do that if you have further sanctions. The Iranians have said very clearly that if there are sanctions, then this separate deal that Turkey and Brazil signed is off. So for them, I think they're in a position where the logic of what they've done, the logic of what they have said, means that they probably will say no. They might abstain. In order to make it less painful in their relationship with the U.S. But my guess would be that they'll probably say no.
A fraught and fascinating moment in U.S.-Turkey relations and much, much more here. Mark Champion with The Wall Street Journal in Istanbul. Thank you very much for being with us, Mark.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about a call for the United States to recenter its Mideast policy from Saudi Arabia and Israel to Turkey and Iran. Joining me now in the studio is Stephen Kinzer, much honored foreign correspondent for the New York Times and the Boston Globe over the years, now teaches international relations at Boston University. His new book is Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Stephen Kinzer, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Great to be with you.
So, when you set out to write this, we didn't have a flotilla raid. We didn't have an Iran-Brazil side deal Turkey-Brazil side deal with Iran. You're calling, as I'm reading this, not to cut off with Saudi Arabia, certainly not to cut off with Israel, but to recenter toward Turkey. Maybe people will understand that, long-term ally. Iran, though, I mean, for heaven's sakes, we've been at sword tips with Tehran for decades now. Does your thesis stand up through this choppy water, or does it look, I don't know, counterfactual now, Steve?
Well, one of the things you learn in many years as a journalist is that some things that are counterfactual actually turn out to be right, and mm-hmm. some things that are totally obvious and make perfect common sense are actually not true. So I start from that perspective. Mm-hmm. I begin with this idea that our policies in the Middle East aren't working for the modern age. Just look at the Middle East today, and you can see that whatever anybody's been doing, it's not working. That's a pit of terror and violence and hatred. So we need something new. I'm trying to think in big terms, which is something that mm-hmm. the American foreign policy establishment is really not very good at. It's a system in which original thinking is sometimes viewed as the bacteria of some terrible new disease that needs to be stamped out immediately.
So give us some. We're ready for it. Do I have it right? Are you saying recenter away from Saudi Arabia and Israel toward Turkey and Iran as kind of anchor allies in the region?
Let me just go through those countries very briefly. With Saudi Arabia, I do think our relationship has become too intense. We're too much on top of Saudi Arabia and on top of the other Arab countries. The Arab countries are the only region of the world where democracy has not taken hold.
So when you say on top of, what do you mean?
We are guiding them too much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a position on every dispute between Arab countries and on many disputes within Arab countries.
So back off, back out a little.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Let Arabia be Arabia. Mm-hmm. America has been afraid of democracy there because we're afraid that it will produce some kind of an Islamist alternative, which is probably true. But let's allow that to happen.
This story we know, Israel.
With Israel, I do think that it's important for the United States to remain a long-term friend and ally of Israel. The question is, what best guarantees Israel's long-term survival? My view is that militarily, Israel's not going to be able to impose its will forever, and that therefore, in the long run, the greatest guarantee for the security of Israel is a calm neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That means that anything we can do to calm the neighborhood down and not intensify confrontations is actually good for Israel.
But that's what
run.
We've been told we've been trying to do forever. Calm it all down. Keep it calm.
Turkey's now providing an alternative answer. What they're saying is your policies are not calming anything. You're too confrontational. You're still back in the Cold War mindset when America could rule. Mm-hmm. Now you've got to ratchet down your ambitions and realize that you've got some partners in this region you ought to listen to a little more carefully. America is not ready for that advice. America doesn't feel that it needs advice on how to run its Middle East policy. And that's what lies behind the breach between Turkey and the United States in recent weeks.
And Iran is a new BFF, best friend forever here, that's hard to picture. We've all seen the, you know, death through the great Satan marches there.
Well, first
back
of
in the
all,
day.
I'm talking about a longer-term project. Mm-hmm. And how do I pick Iran? It's a very good question. I think when countries are looking for partners, mm-hmm. you're looking for countries that fulfill two criteria. One is you want countries whose long-term strategic goals are relatively congruent with your own.
Mm-hmm.
And second, since it's not enough to have just relations between governments or elites, mm-hmm. you want partners whose societies have something in common with yours.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a call for the United States to recenter its Middle East policy from Saudi Arabia and Israel to Turkey and Iran, not to the exclusion of the others, but a real recentering. Stephen Kinzer is with us, much celebrated, much honored foreign correspondent, has worked for the New York Times, the Boston Globe. His new book is Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. It comes right into the middle of a lot of fury and furor in that region after flotilla raid and Iran nuclear program and sanctions push and much more. How upset has Turkey been lately? Well, here's protesters swarming the streets of Istanbul as news spread of the Israeli raid on what was, in essence, a kind of Turkish flotilla headed for Gaza. Stephen Kinzer is with me in the studio. Kenneth Adelman joins us in a moment. I should point out, just for context here, the dedication of your book, Stephen, is to your grandparents, Abraham and Janetta, who died at Bergen-Belsen in the Nazi death camp. So just as a way of understanding your own background, which you put front and center here, some other background here, deep history that I have to say I didn't know at all, which may help Americans understand something of the deeper Iranian attitudes beyond the Death to America banners, the story of Howard Baskerville that you tell here. Give us a little bit of that.
I think I can guarantee that regardless of what readers think about my thesis, if you read my book, you're going to learn a lot about Iran and a lot about Turkey that you didn't know. Mm-hmm. One of the things you're going to learn is the story of Howard Baskerville, who was a 24-year-old school teacher from Nebraska, who went off to Iran in the beginning of the 20th century, in 1908.
Kind of missionary teacher.
He was a school teacher mm-hmm. in Tabriz, and he got caught up in the democratic movement there, which was then at the beginning of trying to establish democracy in Iran.
Northwest Iran, Tabriz. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, near mm-hmm. the Russian and Turkish
right,
borders.
Right.
He actually joined the revolutionary fighters and was killed fighting for democracy in Iran.
Didn't just join, became kind of a leader rallying Iranians for democracy in their own city.
He is sometimes called the American Lafayette in mm-hmm. Iran. And why I start my book with him is because he is an example of how not only American blood has been shed in defense of democracy in Iran, but Iran has 100 years of tradition of trying to get to democracy. The concepts of what is an election, a parliament, a political party are very well known to Iranians.
And it saw in Howard Baskerville an American helping them at the dawn of all this. You quote one of the parliamentarians there back in the day saying, "Young America, in the person of young Baskerville, Baskerville of Nebraska gave this sacrifice to the young constitution of Iran.
It's a remarkable history, and I think it's the beginning.
Shot in the heart in Tabriz.
Exactly. It's the beginning of a century in which Iranians themselves have decided they want democracy. This is something that's in common with Turkey and Iran and with no other country in the Middle East. It's that democracy was not brought to them at the point of a gun by a foreign army. It's something they themselves decided they wanted 100 years ago and have had now generations to assimilate the kinds of ideas that you need to assimilate in order to produce an effective democracy.
But what are you saying? Because Ahmadinejad, you know, I mean, Turkey, just in the last couple of days, Ahmadinejad's been there with the Turks along with Putin and a whole crowd sort of wailing on Israel, not making friendly noises about the United States at a conference there. Iran certainly, very publicly, has not positioned itself as a friend of the United States. Turkey going the opposite direction right now. You heard Mark Champion with the in Istanbul saying at the top of the hour, significant risk of long-term irreparable damage to the U.S.-Turkey relationship in front of us right now. So what do you exactly do you mean here? What would this recentering look like, away from Saudis, away from Israelis, toward Turks and Iranians?
Well, it would have to include, among other things, an acceptance by the United States that it would be a good idea to take some other advice and to listen to some other perspectives about how we approach the Middle East. We're not ready to do that yet. So this is something that's not on the front burner. But as I look over the 21st century, I realize the Cold War has now been over for 20 years. Nonetheless, our policy toward the Middle East has not changed. The strategic environment is completely different. Our opportunities in the 21st century and our challenges are much different from what they were in the past. Therefore, we need to be looking at a bigger picture, at a longer-term future. This is something the American foreign policy establishment does not do well. And what I'm trying to suggest is get past this week's arguments and try to think about where the U.S. should be going in the rest of this century.
Can you ditch Saudi Arabia with all that oil, ditch Israel with its moral claim on American support, with its political claim on American support?
No, you cannot, nor should you. I think if it became a little more difficult for Americans to get crude oil from Saudi Arabia, that might be a good thing for us. It might help us break our addiction. As for Iran, I would like to see the U.S. make an offer of unconditional negotiations now, and let's see what could be produced by that. I would have liked to see the U.S. grab on to the Turkey-Brazil offer and say, maybe we can build on this. But it's obvious that the U.S. is not looking for a way out of this confrontation. It has its own ideas about how it's going to bring Iran to heel. Turkey doesn't think that's going to work, and I think that's the beginning of this argument. The bigger argument is, what should be the way the U.S. approaches the Middle East? In its traditional confrontational way, or should it listen to Turkey and realize that in the long run, stability is also what's good for us in the region?
And if Turkey and Iran were our number one allies in the region, that would mean more stability? Why?
Let's take Iran first, which is the little harder one to swallow. Iran, first of all, has a great ability to stabilize Iraq. In fact, Iran...
Or the opposite.
Or the opposite. Iran, if it wanted to, could be our ticket out of Iraq. It could guarantee that after our withdrawal, there's not some new explosion of violence. In addition, Iran has great ability to influence Afghanistan. Iran has a long history of fighting with militant Sunni groups like al-Qaeda and Taliban. Iran's oil industry needs huge investment, which the U.S. is very well placed to provide, and is now opening up its economic opportunities to other countries because we're not taking advantage of them. So in the long run, not only does Iran have these congruent interests with us, but its society is so vibrantly democratic. You know, after the last round of violence, after last year's elections, many people, including myself, were quite shocked by the level of violence government used. On the other hand, to me, the bigger story was the protest itself. It shows how demanding Iranians are when it comes to democracy. You would never see post-election protests in Saudi Arabia because there are no elections, or post-election protests in Egypt because in Egypt everyone expects elections to be stolen.
We're going to have Stephen Kinzer hash this out in just a moment with Kenneth Edelman. Let me get a call here first or two. Cuba, calling from Bloomfield, Connecticut. Cuba, you're on the air.
Yes. The question is, the latest escapade by Israel inside Asia Minor, is this the beginning of, I should say, is this the beginning of the end of this state Israel, or is it the start of Israel exceptionalism moving away from the moral imperatives of Kant and actually embracing Arendt's selfishness? And how is that is going to affect the United States exceptionalism within the region, as you so vividly pointed out in your discussion?
Phuwa, you're thinking grand scale along with Steve Kinzer here. Thank you for your call, Steve. What about it?
I think that Israel has taken a political journey from the days of Ben-Gurion and Abba Ibn and Golda Meir. It's gotten to be a much more religious state. It's gotten to become much more militant in many ways. And what I fear about Israel is that some Israeli leaders have lost sight of what's really good for Israel in the long run. They're falling victim to the same problem that we in America have, which is just thinking about next week and next month and not trying to think about the long-term future. I would like to see Israel and Iran make important security concessions. However, countries only make security concessions when they feel safe. Therefore, it should be in the interest of the United States to do whatever is necessary to stabilize and calm the Middle East. I believe that Turkey's approach of trying to resolve some of these crises by diplomacy and negotiation would not only serve Turkish interests and American interests, but it would definitely serve Israeli interests as well.
One more call, then Ken Edelman. Bob in Montreal, Canada. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, I spent quite a bit of time in Turkey, and I'd like to say the West alienated Turkey to a great extent. Without getting into details, the EU snubbed the country and basically shut the door to eventual membership to Ankara. But what many people, I think, forget is that although Turkey wishes to champion the rights of oppressed people such as the Palestinians, they're not actually a darling in the region either. They have big problems with the Greeks. They've occupied northern Cyprus in a military operation, which is rather bloody and illegal. They also have big problems with the Kurds in their own country, and they're engaged in a 25-year-old military operation. And they also violate human rights in that country. And also they have problems with their Armenian neighbors. They refuse to acknowledge the genocide of 1915. So they do have claims to be a regional superpower, but they're certainly not an angelic nation.
Bob, we've got it. Stephen, Kinzer, what about it? No paragon here.
Well, first of all, let me say that you're absolutely right about the EU. You have to think back now. If
that
the
long
EU,
wait for membership never consummated.
If the EU had not slammed the door in Turkey's face, would Turkey be acting as it is now? Maybe not. Maybe Turkey would be devoting its global energies towards anchoring itself in the European project.
Yeah.
So the EU has some questions to ask itself. As to Turkey being less than an angelic nation, that's certainly true. As Turkey promotes the idea that all disputes should be settled by diplomacy and conciliation, the natural answer is, what about the Kurds? Why don't you try that with them? So until Turkey can resolve that problem, and it's somewhat less urgent problems with Armenia and over Cyprus, it's not going to be able to play fully the role that I think ultimately it could play as a conciliator in the region and the world.
Stephen Kinzer, stand by. I want to bring in from Washington, if I may, Kenneth Edelman, a prominent voice in conservative and pro-Israel policy circles, been called a lifelong neocon activist, held big positions in Republican administrations in the Pentagon, State Department, more going back to the Ford administration, UN ambassador and director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency under President Ronald Reagan, talked about cakewalk with Iraq after the war, had a kind of mea culpa out to the world, but always thoughtful. Kenneth Edelman, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
What do you make of Stephen Kinzer's sort of, we're talking long term here now, but he's looking out at the horizon saying, need to recenter USA, recenter, you know, pulling a bit away from Saudi Arabia and Israel and significantly toward Turkey and Iran. Can you see it?
I thought the book was very well written. I thought it was well researched, and I learned a lot from the book. I think it's true, as Stephen says, that it's a big think. It's original thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I just think the thesis is something I don't believe a word of it. And I think it's very original, but it seems kind of crazy to me.
Well, fill it out. Why?
Well, because Stephen makes the point that he just made on the air, 30 seconds ago, that, Turkey, there's no other democratic country in the Middle East. Well, he's forgetting, too, Israel and Iraq right now. And when he says in his book very clearly that Turkey and Iran, quote, developed an understanding of democracy that makes them a good soulmate for America, it's just a very, very peculiar as Turkey, as you mentioned, the its past is rather spotty. Certainly, the military has stepped in a number of times and taken over the government and then turned it over back.
Founded the government, essentially.
But then they stepped in and stepped out and, you know, over the years. And so it hasn't been a great democracy. The only country has been for 60 years a great democracy in terms of threat, even though it's been threatened, even though it's been in wars all too much, is Israel. So if the bind is a democratic spirit, then Israel has it. And I don't know where Stephen is looking around. On Iran, it's just a very peculiar thesis. You know, from simple terms, I don't understand the background of Iran like Stephen does, and I admire the way he understands it and the way he writes about it. He writes beautifully about it. But the, you know, in simple terms, Iran had 30 years of dictatorship under the Shah and 30 years of tyranny under the mullahs. And this is a democratic country? Now, he's talking about the long run. I understand that. But if he's for regime change, which I think is a great idea, but I think he'd be very reluctant to join the neocons on
we'll ask,
regime
we'll
change.
Ask, yep.
Yeah, I know. But the fact is that, you know, if it becomes a different country, but, you know, statesmen and people that Stephen covered when he was with the New York Times, they have to deal with the country as it is. And 60 years, the last 60 years, Iran has not been a democratic country in any sense. So I just don't know what he's thinking about it. Now, you can say, yes, for 60 years, but remember Baskerville. Remember 1906, 1909. Okay, that was a long time ago. And then someone, you know, from Chicago, the Chicago Cubs said, you know, they had a bad century.
But a century is a long time. Ken, let me ask you, if I may, we'll put all that to Stephen, but what about on the other side of the ledger? A lot of people are worried right now about the sustainability of Middle East stability within the context of a U.S.-Turkey relationship that's badly frayed and a U.S.-Israel relationship that doesn't seem to be holding the same water it once did.
No, I think that's a very good point, Tom. The Turkish relationship is badly frayed because I think Turkey has just lost sight of its, you know, its way. I think that when they call Israel a country of state terrorism, A, I don't believe it, but B, then they welcome the president of Iran as of yesterday, and they don't care about Iranian terrorism. They don't care about Iranian support of Hamas and Hezbollah. They don't care about Iranian denial of the Holocaust and wanting to annihilate Israel. They don't care about the, you know, their great love of democracy, in both countries' love of democracy, that there's rape in the jails of Iran for those who have been simply protesting to have a democratic government in Iran. This is cockamamie and very aggravating on them. Plus, the fact is, it's interesting that Turkey is so in favor these days of Palestinian homeland and all that. It's a good argument to make. It's an argument I happen to believe. And so I'm supporting on that. But how about homeland for the Turks?
For the Kurds.
For the Kurds.
But can't hold the thought.
The Kurds, the Turks haven't been very favorable towards that. In fact, they have used measures far beyond what the Israelis have ever used on the Palestinians.
Ken Edelman, please stand by if you would, because we've got a break coming. Right?
Stunning.
We'll come right back, Ken. Stephen Kinzer, just a word from you before we go. I mean, Ken says, full respect, deep respect, but crazy thesis.
All I would argue in reply is that, as Albert Einstein once said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. I can understand that some people would have some trouble with my thesis, and I don't want to insist that it's the only way to reorganize the Middle East. But what I would insist on is, let's think big. Let's come up with some new ideas. Let's break away from the past.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a call for the United States to recenter its Mideast policy from Saudi Arabia and Israel to Turkey and Iran. It's the premise of a new book by Stephen Kinzer, a longtime correspondent, great correspondent, much awarded and celebrated for the New York Times and Boston Globe. His new book is Reset: Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Kenneth Edelman is with us as well, prominent voice in foreign policy in the United States, prominent neocon for a long time, big positions in many Republican administrations going all the way back to Reagan and Ford. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Who can, who should the United States count on in this important region? And can you picture Turkey and Iran as key allies? Is the world changing faster than we knew? President Obama thinking, at least appearing to think, somewhere along these lines, just after his inauguration in 2009, he spoke with the Al-Arabiya, the Arab-based television station, about his hope to make progress in Middle East peace and holding out a hand to Iran.
As I said during my inauguration speech, if countries like Iran are willing to unclench their fist, they will find an extended hand from us.
An extended hand. But new best friends, what about it? Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, Howard Baskerville country in Nebraska a century ago. Elaine, you're on the air, Elaine.
Hello there. Well, several points. First of all, I think that we need to support peaceful relationships among all the nations of the Middle East. Why do we have to have just friends and enemies? Why do we have to have a best friend in Israel mm-hmm. and everybody else is down the line? I think we really need to acknowledge the virtues and the sins of each country, including Israel, which has nuclear weapons and which disobeys and flaunts several UN resolutions as well as Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. But we never say anything about that. I mean, we need to hold them to account and ask them to be a good neighbor to all their neighbors as well as saying that they have a right to exist. And secondly, we need to acknowledge our own past sins and errors in that region. I mean, we supported the Shah of Iran. I think it was Mr. Edelman who mm-hmm. said that Iran
60 years without democracy. Yeah.
Of the Shah. Well, mm-hmm. we supported the Shah of Iran. We also supported Saddam Hussein in Iraq before he became our enemy.
We supported the assassination of his democratically elected predecessor. So, yes, point taken. Elaine, let us pick all that up, if we may. Ken Edelman, first to the question Elaine raises from Omaha. You know, why have friends and enemies in the Middle East? And why best friend Israel above all?
Well, because that's the way the world works. That's the way Elaine's life works in Omaha. She has friends. She has relatives. She has people who she shares her values with. She has people that she really likes. She has people that interests coincide with her, that activities coincide with her, whether it's in the PTA or her bowling league or her book club or whatever. That's the way the world works. And that's the way Stephen is recommending that we practice Middle East diplomacy. And Stephen's absolutely right on this. You share values. We're closer to Japan in Asia than we are to North Korea because our values coincide and our our views of the world coincide very much. So I think it's naive to say, excuse me, let's just treat everybody the same. Everybody doesn't merit treatment the same. Second point I would make is that you can chuckle, Tom, about the United States supporting the Shah and, go into 1953, and we've all been through that.
Stephen's written about it at length, yeah.
And yeah, but, I mean, it's not something to chuckle about. The fact is that the Shah was an autocratic leader. He did terrible things at the end of his regime, but nothing as bad as the mullahs have done. Nothing as destructive to the whole Middle East as the mullahs have done. And the fact is, if I had to choose between those two, I'm not talking about choosing between Jefferson and Madison here, but choosing between the way the Shah ruled Iran for roughly 30 years and the way the crazy Muslims have ruled Iran for the last 30 years, I would certainly choose the Shah over them.
But our embrace lost Iran to us for nearly 30 years.
I don't think
now.
That's true. I don't think, Tom, I just don't think that's true. I'm happy to do a two against one on this show, but I just don't think you're accurate, Tom. I don't think we lost Iran. I think that the Shah made decisions that were very difficult on the modernization. I think that he offended a lot of people, and rightly so, because of his practices. But and that's a difficult history in that.
Well, let's agree.
Overall,
Iran was
leader,
lost
but,
to
but,
us.
But don't say. But don't say we lost Iran. That's just not true, Tom.
Well, we'll agree to disagree.
Listen, you can chuckle all you want.
It's not about lightheartedness. It's about trying to keep some perspective on everything that's going on here. And I respect yours, Ken. Stephen Kinzer, you hear our caller from Omaha. She says, let's not have friends and enemies here. But you're not saying that either.
No, he's saying the opposite.
I think Ken and I would probably
agree on this point. In fact, his comments make me think I should publish a different version of my book with just like the last 35 pages not included, because then Ken would have loved it. He said he liked all the history, which mm-hmm. is basically 80% of the book. Mm-hmm. So maybe that would be another version.
You've got a different
of
conclusion off that history.
Let me
I
just
would do
respond.
That, and I would change the title too to from Reset to Examination, In-Depth Understanding of Two Important Countries in the Middle East. And then I would think it's a terrific book, Stephen.
Well, that's a title I'm not so sure what would fit on the cover, but thanks for that. Let me just add one point to comment on what the caller said. In one sense, Israel and Iran are in comparable positions now. They're the two countries in the Middle East that a lot of their neighbors don't like and trust, and they're the two countries that many countries in the world don't like or trust. There's a lot of anti-Iran emotion and anti-Israel emotion running around the world mm-hmm. right now. Many countries would like to punish or sanction or somehow work out their angry emotions at these countries. This is a mistake. There is no major security issue in the Middle East that can be solved without Israel and Iran. To sanction these countries and push them into corners and make them feel alone and friendless mm-hmm. is only ratcheting up confrontations. We ought to be trying to find ways to draw them out of their isolation and into some kind of new regional security architecture.
But Ken says regime change is the answer for Iran.
No, I am saying that Stephen says that, and I agree with him because he puts it as forward very clearly. This may have to take a new regime in a new leadership in Iran, and if that's his view, welcome to the neocon camp.
Well, it's a
Stephen.
Little bit different from the active voice regime change, but I take your point. What do you say, Steve?
What I'm saying is that it may be difficult to reach any accord with this regime, but we should still try. However, I think most Iranians or many Iranians would like to see a transition to another regime. I'm just back from Iran. I just mm-hmm. spent 2 weeks traveling mm-hmm. around Iran and talking to people. And the response I got from everybody is, look, we tried something last year. Mm-hmm. It didn't work.
Now, basically got crushed.
It got crushed. Mm-hmm. Now we just have to go back and live our lives. Change will happen, but it won't happen soon. Now, when you're a country with 25 centuries of history, which is 10 times longer than the U.S., mm-hmm. that's a very understandable attitude. In the U.S., we like to think everything has a quick solution. Iranians think differently. They would think that there are many problems that not only don't have quick solutions, they don't have any solutions at all.
So let's take a more languorous view of this. If things don't change in the direction that you're describing, what do you see down that road?
Well, what I would like to see is the U.S. make a real effort to see if we can strike a deal with this regime. This is a regime that very much sees its own interests, I think, in the world.
A deal and around nuclear program?
It could not be limited to the nuclear issue. That's mm-hmm. why negotiations have failed up to now. Mm-hmm. We're asking Iran to negotiate only on the issue that we care about. If we open up the agenda and allow Iran to bring up the questions that it has, its complaints about the U.S., which is what we did when we began our opening with China, and begin a broader negotiation, then, although I would hardly think it would be a cakewalk, it's a possibility, and I'd like to see us test that a little more than we have.
If we don't do that with Iran, if relations with Turkey deteriorate, what's down that road?
I think it just means more confrontation and more violence in the Middle East.
Let's go to Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Great panel. I love to listen to your show. I want to make a couple of points here real quick, and I'll be concise. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can trust either Erdogan or Ahmadinejad.
The leaders of Turkey and Iran, yeah.
Yeah, as the day after U.S. troops leave Iraq, I would guarantee you there's going to be border incidents in western Iran with the Arabs and eastern Turkey with the Kurds that will justify in their minds an invasion division of Kurdistan by Turkey and Iran. They probably already have the map drawn up. And Europe and America will do nothing, just as we did nothing when Germany took Sudetenland. And we have to re-examine Turkey's participation in NATO after divulging NATO secrets and plans to Ahmadinejad and a Republican Guard. I think we have a real issue here, and it's going to get ugly.
Interesting. Steve Kinzer, first to you. There's not a lot of confidence there, but rather a sort of a play for Kurdistan, Alan sees coming.
There's no doubt that Erdogan is an emotional figure, and he's become, I think, too confrontational in these last weeks, and Ahmadinejad is, of course, off the map on that scale. I don't think that there's going to be any kind of a joint move against Kurdistan. That was talked about some time ago, but Turkey has actually finally realized that it's a good idea for them to build up good relations with the Kurdish regime in northern Iraq. That's been happening. It's one of the big changes in that region, and a very positive one.
Let's go to Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Steve and Ken. Well, you talk about Iran. Nobody lost Iran. Just real quick, I guess you could say nobody, we didn't lose it. Jimmy Carter helped give it away. He tied the Shah's hands when there was trouble, and the Shah could have probably cleaned things up in several months. His tactics would have been rough, but better than what they are today. So, I mean, we didn't lose Iran. Like I said, Jimmy Carter helped facilitate the loss of Iran.
Well, it's been gone for a while. Let's put it that way. Look forward, Jerry. What do you see?
Well, what I see, I don't know how you can sit down with a person who says he wants to destroy the United States of America and wants to wipe Israel off the map. I mean, how can you sit down and have a conversation? I mean, how do you start? You can't start with a madman. This man is a Hitler in our time, and people do not understand the mindset of these people. They're waiting for the 12th imam to come back so they can set up their Muslim kingdom.
You're talking about Ahmadinejad. Let me take it to Steve Kinzer. You're proposing that we sit down with Hitler in our time, Steve?
Well, I think the media image of Ahmadinejad is a little bit exaggerated. I do think, however, that Ahmadinejad has played this very well. He understands that he's not popular in Iran, and he knows there's only one thing that would really make him popular, and that is to be attacked. That would not only make him a hero in Iran, but throughout the Middle East, if he could get Israel or the U.S. to bomb him. And I think he's calculating, what can I do that's going to make them the craziest?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll say there was no Holocaust, and I'll say Israel should fade from the map of history. I don't think he's ever said he should destroy the U.S.,
but if that's what he wants, what's the point of trying to sit down? If he's willing to go to that extent to support himself politically at home.
I think it's always a good idea to probe people who we consider to be our enemies and figure out what they really want when they're inside a room. That was our problem with Mossadegh in 1953. We overthrew him, but we never made an effort to understand, who is this guy? What does he want? Can we make a deal with him? I'm not saying that deal is out there for us in Iran, but I am saying we haven't really made an effort to find out.
Ken Edelman, worth a try?
I think that's what we've been doing for the last 18 months, and so I don't know where Stephen's been during that time. I think that the idea of the Obama administration was to talk about Iran. Second point I would make is that I agree with the caller that it seems very difficult to negotiate with people like that. Third point I'd make is that I can't stand Stephen. As much as I respect his writing and respect his analysis and his history is wonderful, I just can't stand Stephen equating Israel and Iran. Their values are totally different. Their presence on the world stage is totally different. Their treatment of minorities is totally different. Their respect for democracy is totally different. And the thrust of The Reset, the book Stephen is writing, is that countries come together because of values. And therefore, because of what he calls the ardor for democracy in Iran, which he puts in his book, that therefore they make a natural ally to the United States. But the ardor for democracy is in Israel for 60 years. And today, I think it is in Iraq. Why doesn't he include Iraq in this equation as a more natural ally? But the idea of this ardor for democracy in Iran after 60 years of having no democracy and a little flicker with Baskerville and, you know, that little episode
and the protest
that he tells very nicely, is just kind of crazy.
Stephen,
The last point I would make is our objections to Iran are not because of lack of diplomacy, lack of conversation. They're not because only of the nuclear issue. Iran is the biggest perpetuator of terrorism anywhere in the world. And that has been true, proclaimed by Democratic presidents, by Republican presidents, by presidents over the last 30 years. And what we are for, what decent people are for, is not a regime that funds terrorism wherever it can start, wherever it can find it, and causes problems like that. And
Stephen
rolls over that.
Stephen Kinzer, how about it? There's a lot on the table. It kind of goes to the heart of things.
Well, let me just say, respond to two of your points, Ken. First of all, I don't compare Iran and Israel in terms of their internal political systems, and I think your distinction between them is very accurate. But I do think they're in somewhat similar positions in terms of the eyes of the world and the eyes of the countries in that region. They're both seen as kind of outcasts. Now, it may be unjustifiable that people think of them this way, but I do think in that sense they are.
But you are pointing to raw material in Iran for a kind of great American ally, and Ken's questioning that.
I do think the raw material is there, and I think Iran is at a place where Iraq might be at in 20 or 50 years after it's had generations of experience with democracy. This is something you cannot replace, these years of trying to understand what is democracy. And okay, let me just add one other point.
Ken, our time is so short. I want to get Steve's response.
You don't need to negotiate with your friends. They already agree with you. What you need to do is negotiate with the people that hate you, that want to kill your children. That's the only way you're going to resolve problems in the world. Negotiating with people who already agree with you isn't necessary. It's kinds of regimes like Iran that we really need to think about finding ways to engage.
What happens if we don't, if we stick with something closer to a status quo American alliance set?
I think we're going to see a continuing escalation of conflicts in the Middle East. Centrifuges will continue to spin in Iran. And then we are going to face this highly destabilizing possibility of Iran becoming a nuclear weapons power. Our policy is aimed at heading that off. But in the last couple of years, that policy has had zero effect. All the centrifuges are spinning. There's more and more every day. So we're not getting anywhere. We're not achieving a result. I'm not necessarily against sanctions as an idea or a principle, but I don't understand where they're expected to get us.
Ken Edelman shakes his head and says, you know, this is so counterfactual, this is never going to happen. Steve?
Well, I think it is counterfactual. It's counterinstinctive, and I like doing that. That's one reason why I left the daily newspaper business. And I think many of Ken's observations are very accurate. I'm trying to stir the pot here. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to have people engaged who don't agree with my thesis, and so I find this whole dialogue all to the good because we're thinking about new ideas, big ideas, and long-term future.
Well, the news itself is making us look at everything anew. Lots and lots of challenges and new challenges out there. I'm grateful to each of you for helping us look at those today. Kenneth Edelman in Washington, it's great to have you with us. Thank you very much for your thoughts and time today, Ken.
You're welcome.
And Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Very thought-provoking, Stephen. Thank you very much for being here.
It's great to have you provoke my thoughts.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.